Welcome to A Time for Change. I'm Sibyl Marcellus here with Alexis Christophorus. All eyes are on Afghanistan right now. As evacuations continue, President Biden is considering whether or not he's going to stick to his August 31st deadline for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. He's expected to make an announcement about that today. But even when the last soldier comes on, the cost comes home, the cost of war will continue for decades to come.
And according to a recent study, by the year 2050, the cost of caring for post-9/11 veterans will reach more than $2 trillion. Our first guest is the author of that study. Dr. Linda Bilmes is the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Senior Lecturer in Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. And Dr. Bilmes, it's great to have you here on the show. Thanks so much for being with us. I know that one of the things you looked at in this study is the ability of the U.S. government to make good on its financial promises to these veterans. What did your study reveal?
Well, I think it's important to note that the U.S. fighting in Afghanistan may be over, but paying for veterans care is just beginning. There's always a long tail of costs after a war is over. So, for example, the peak year of paying veterans benefits for World War II veterans was in 1986, and we haven't yet reached the peak paying disability benefits for Vietnam veterans. But this time it's going to be a much bigger, longer, thicker tail because we already have 1.8 million veterans from the post-9/11 wars who are already awarded lifetime disability benefits and care. And these their needs are going to grow as they always do as they get older and have more complications from whatever disability or injury they have had. Do you want, I can talk about this at length. Yeah.
We will definitely get into it, but I wanted to ask, how many trillions of dollars could the U.S. be saving by withdrawing U.S. troops from the country?
You're asking a very good question. Let me put this in context. This is the first, these are what I call the credit card wars. These are the first wars the U.S. has fought where we have not actually paid anything for the wars yet. So going back in history during Vietnam, during Korea, during World War I, World War II, back to the Spanish-American War, War of 1812, taxes were always raised to pay for these wars and sometimes a lot. So during the Korean War, President Truman raised taxes, top marginal rates to 92% to pay for those wars, to pay as you go, as he put it. And President Johnson raised top rates over 75% during the Vietnam War. Now, of course, during these wars, taxes have been cut three times in 2001, 2003, and 2017. So we haven't yet paid for anything for these wars. So we already have a huge amount of debt. So the question is not only how much money it costs year on year, but also how we how we pay for the wars. And one
exactly.
of the things that my
yeah, doctor, I don't mean to cut you off, but I was just going to ask. I mean, does this then set up the U.S. government to possibly have to renege on these promises that it made to these veterans, which let's admit is a huge incentive for a lot of these veterans, the benefits that they're going to get from the U.S. government? Did your study reveal that it's a real possibility that the government may not be able to live up to those promises?
I think that I am concerned that the government might renege on its promises to this generation of veterans because of the fact that we already owe many, many, many trillions of dollars for the war, the credit card wars. And I have proposed a Veterans Trust Fund, which is an accounting mechanism, but it is a way that the government sets aside, begins to set aside some funding specifically for a specific purpose and requires that the government has a function to keep track of and to monitor the long-term obligations to this group of veterans. The government right now has been expanding veterans care. The Department of Veterans Affairs has generally performed increasingly well, particularly on the medical side over the last 20 years. It has expanded care into communities. It has expanded care for mental health care, for women's care. It has expanded a wide variety of types of care, and of course, medical care in general has improved but become more complex. But this generation of veterans coming home has multiple conditions. They were exposed to more combat on average than previous generations of veterans due to the way that these wars were fought with a small all-volunteer force supplemented with contractors. So there is the question of how sustainable is it to continue paying rapidly expanding departments of Veterans Affairs if we did not set aside any funding for veterans beforehand, and I believe that we should start doing so.
More than 40% of troops who have served in Iraq, Afghanistan, and related locations have already been approved for lifetime disability benefits. Do you expect that even more troops will qualify? Because even if the U.S. withdraws troops on that August 31st deadline and the fighting is over, there's still the mental and physical ongoing impacts of war.
That's absolutely right. And of course, you have millions of young men and women who are still serving in the military, who have served in these wars, who have not yet become veterans. So that's right. But in general, you have this is a good thing, of course. There is better medical care. There is a much higher survival rate among this group of veterans. There is much better communication to veterans about what they are eligible for. There is much more outreach by the veterans organizations and the Department of Veterans Affairs. There are more generous veterans. And so all of these things mean that the cost absolutely will continue to go up. And my figure of $2.2 to $2.5 trillion for the long-term cost of veterans care, that is a very conservative number.
Dr. Bilmes, I know that you say the government's estimates of the financial cost of the post-9/11 wars vastly underestimates the actual total costs of war. Can you sort of lay out for us how so, and in what ways have they underestimated the costs?
I first started studying this in 2005, and my co-author, Joe Stiglitz, and I wrote the book, The $3 Trillion War, in 2008. And at that point, we estimated that was the minimum that these wars could cost. But the way that we have budgeted for these wars the way we have budgeted for the wars meant that the war spending was done initially for a decade through emergency money that doesn't go through the usual checks and balances and oversight as regular government spending. And since then, through a mechanism called Overseas Contingency Operation Funding, which again goes through a somewhat separate process. So there has been very little oversight on a lot of the ways that money has been spent. That means that we have probably spent far more than we absolutely needed to. We have also, the way that many contracts have been written for the military contractors that have been a vital part of this conflict, the incentive structures in many of those contracts have incentivized a higher than necessary amount of spending. There have been essentially no restrictions on how much could be spent. Now, that is all what has been spent. As I have mentioned, the war has not been paid for at all yet. This has all been paid for on borrowed money, which is the first time in U.S. war history that we have ever paid for a war entirely through debt. This is really a new thing. So we have the interest on the debt that needs still to be paid. We have long-term cost of taking care of veterans. We have long-term costs associated with replenishing equipment, replenishing and what the military calls reset in terms of the actual military forces, as well as a whole series of costs associated with depreciation of equipment and machinery and weaponry.
Unfortunately, we don't have much time left, but I do want to ask you this. As the daughter of a World War II veteran, how have you noticed that it's changed, the caring of veterans, from post-World War II to post-9/11 in terms of costs?
I think that it's important to understand that the number of veterans in the population has become much smaller over the past 20 years. So 20 years ago, when my father and many other World War II veterans were still alive, one in every four American men was a veteran. That number is now one in eight. And in another 20 years, it will be one in 12 or one in 14. So things have changed in terms of the awareness of the costs of the war, in terms of the immediate awareness of having a family member who has served in the military, and having and I think that the number of people in the population who have lived with this is much smaller. But let me just mention one more thing. One of the reasons that my numbers are so conservative is because the U.S. has not really reckoned yet with the cost of the exposure to burn pits and other toxins that many hundreds of thousands of veterans in the First Gulf War, as well as Afghanistan and Iraq, were exposed to. The Department of Veterans Affairs has just made it a little bit easier for veterans to claim for respiratory ailments associated with exposures to burn pits, but there are a whole range of conditions that have recently been the subject of medical research and will probably shortly be certified as being connected. And that will absolutely expand and probably explosively expand the number of veterans who are eligible for things that they know are not right about themselves, but be able to more easily claim benefits. We have also not, as a country, dealt with the long-term costs of all of the military contractors who have served in these wars and who are not eligible for the same benefits, but who will be paid for through subsidized healthcare and Medicare, and who have also been exposed to burn pits and many other risks and hazards.
Absolutely. Well, these are fascinating insights and things our government needs to address for sure. Dr. Linda Bilmes at Harvard Kennedy School, thanks so much for your time today.
And coming up,
thank you. What's being done to protect the Afghan people who worked with the U.S. military all of these years? We're going to be talking with a U.S. Marine veteran about what he's doing to help right after this. Welcome back to A Time for Change. Continuing our look now at the cost of war in Afghanistan, over the last 20 years, tens of thousands of Afghan nationals have worked with the U.S. government in Afghanistan, many as interpreters, and now their lives are very much on the line, especially with the Taliban saying today it will block all Afghans from the Kabul airport.
Our next guest is working to help bring some of those Afghan people to safety. His name is Charlie Reeder. He served two tours in Afghanistan with the Marines and returned once as a defense contractor. Now, Charlie, I hear that your own interpreter is still in Afghanistan. Tell us about him and efforts that you're making to try to bring him to safety.
Yes, absolutely. He's still over there. You know, he's somebody that I served with back in around 2012 and sort of kept in contact over the years, and found out that his application had been denied recently as of 2019. And we you know, tried to get him through the process again. And you know, with the current change over to the Taliban, it was even more important to get him out as soon as possible. So for the past week, we've been fighting, trying to get him through every checkpoint we can at the airport. However, as the week progresses, it's becoming increasingly harder to do so. And unfortunately, last night, we were able to get him through to a safe location that was controlled by the British and the Americans. And once he was in, they noticed that his visa application was still in process, has not been approved yet by the State Department. And the very same Marines that he'd been serving for the past 17 years kicked him out of that facility. So now he is back out in the city on his own.
So Charlie, tell us some of the things you're doing. I know you're working with a number of groups to try to get these people out of Afghanistan. Tell us about those efforts and how people hearing this interview might be able to help support those efforts.
Sure. So we've been working a program, what's been called the Digital Dunkirk. So we are a collection of veterans, civilians, people in the military, in defense agencies and around the world that are trying to essentially get as many of the interpreters and those who have helped us overseas in Afghanistan out as soon as possible. And, you know, we've been coordinating between each group, trying to find exfil routes for them out of the city, or to the airports are just trying to push as hard as we can to get their paperwork through and approved by the State Department. For those who are wanting to help, the best thing you can do is hound your congressmen, hound your elected officials. Don't let them get a moment's rest while this is still going on. We only have a few short days until the drop dead time that was put in place by this administration. And if that's allowed to continue and go through, then these people will be in a really dire situation.
Charlie, looking back, the war in Afghanistan, was it worth it for you, for Afghanistan, and for the U.S.?
You know, that's a really hard question to answer. And it's one that I've definitely been struggling with for the past couple of days, for this entire week. You know, if I told myself if we can get through as many people as possible, then yeah, it would be worth it, at least getting the people out that put everything on the line to help us accomplish our mission overseas. If we get them home, great. Then I will, you know, have some form of accomplishment for our time served there. If not, this is getting even worse than what it was before we even showed up. And, you know, the entire Afghan government's completely dismantled and it's going to be taken back over by the Taliban. So we're right back to square one.
Charlie, first of all, I want to thank you for your service to this country, having served two tours from 2006 to 10 and then going back as a contractor during this war. Talk to us about what you would tell our U.S. government if President Biden were to give you 5 minutes. What would you say to him as he considers whether or not to withdraw all troops by that August 31st deadline?
I'd say you can't do it. You are going to you literally put these people on a death sentence if you do that. If you do not extend that deadline and actually work and get all these people out, push the Taliban out of Kabul while you do it, so everyone has a safe passage to the airports and get home, get back to wherever they want to go, whether it's, you know, the United States or somewhere else in the world, just getting out of there for what they've done for us. You know, you can't abandon them. You know, I mean, they've put in some, you know, 20 years worth of service. If you were in the military and did 20 years, you'd be looking at retirement and a pension. And, you know, we can't even promise them safety. So if you actually want to save these people, you cannot allow this deadline to expire.
Charlie, you said your former interpreter is on his own right now. What
Yes.
kind of danger is he in? What's his life like right now in Afghanistan?
He's in extreme danger. They are actively hunting him. He's had to move locations around 10 to 12 different times. They've harassed his family members. And, you know, his family has suffered multiple assaults since this week has began. And he's not the only one. They have actual groups that are going around door-to-door hunting these people. You know, they have access to some of our equipment that we left behind, including our biometrics. So it's real easy for them to figure out who's been helping us for the past 20 years. And, you know, recently, early this week, one of the other Terps that we had recently started working with was shot and killed in his own house because of it.
What else can you tell us about your time spent there and what it was like dealing with the Taliban? We're just trying to get a sense of what people's lives are like right now while they're trying to flee.
I mean, my time there, you know, I thought Afghanistan was one of the most beautiful countries I'd ever seen. It was absolutely gorgeous. The people there are extremely friendly. Some of the most humble, honorable people you'll ever meet. And so to see them go through this is absolutely heartbreaking. You know, it's not a fate that they deserve. And, you know, nobody likes the Taliban over there. They want them out just as much as we do. And, you know, they've been fighting with us for 20 years to do so, and to just abandon them at the last minute is again, like I said, heartbreaking. I mean, if you ask any veteran who served over there, you know, if we left, would they still be able to stand on their own? You would probably get an answer of probably not. And we knew that once the U.S. pulled out, it would probably go back to Taliban control. We just, you know, no one expected that fast.
Charlie, many vets are angry and upset at how this withdrawal happened, but polls show that the majority of Americans support the withdrawal of troops from the country. How do you feel about how most Americans view this troop withdrawal or the need to have it?
I understand their need to have it and why they want this war to finally be over. It's been 20 years. It's been a drain on everyone emotionally, physically, and financially to continue to do this. And it's cost the lives of, you know, thousands of Americans, tens of thousands of Afghans, and hasn't really accomplished much at the end of the day. So in any civilian's eyes, why would we continue to keep fighting this? You know, me and many other vets are of the opposite opinion that, you know, we still need to continue to fight in Afghanistan and make sure that that country is secure. Sometimes that looks like nation building, and in a sense, yes, it is. But you can't pound a country into a ground for 20 years and then leave and say it's your problem now. You just can't do that. You know, nobody will ever trust us again if that's what we do.
Many complex issues there, both for Afghanistan and for the U.S. Charlie Reeder, great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to A Time for Change. President Joe Biden intends to stick to the current August 31st deadline to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. That's going to leave a narrow timeline to finish evacuating Americans and Afghan allies. There is, though, according to sources, a contingency plan in place to stay longer if the mission requires it. And Sabeel, in our previous segment, we heard from a former Marine who did two tours in Afghanistan between 2006 and 10, and we asked him about whether or not President Biden should extend that withdrawal of troops. And he said absolutely that it would be a death sentence for those left behind if he doesn't. So clearly there is a lot of work to be done. That's going to do it today for A Time for Change for both Sabeel Marcellus and myself, Alexis Christophorus. Do stay with us. There is more Yahoo Finance Live to come, including a look at the markets where we have got both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 in record territory. We're back right after this.